Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal. We have my co-host, Eagle One from Eagle Speak, on board today. This is usually when we're here live that I invite people to come in and join the chat room. Unfortunately, there seems to be a software error with the live chat room. So I can't invite you there. I'll keep trying to refresh. If it comes on board, I'll let the folks who are with us live know. But I am monitoring my X/Twitter account. So if you have some observations about the show you would like to share with us, or some questions you'd like to direct to our guest at CDR Salamander on Twitter/X, I'll be having it up during the course of the show, and I'll be glad to grab your ideas and throw it in there. But besides that, with the intro, let's hop in directly to today's show. Back on the 12th of February, our guest today had a guest post on my Substack. I'll do a little quote for it. Quote, "The combat performance of U.S. Navy's destroyers in the Red Sea against a variety of weapons employed by the Houthis in Yemen stands as a monument to decades of brilliance, hard work, and dedication across generations of naval officers, of government civilians, industry executives, talented engineers and technologists, assembly line workers, and shipbuilders. This is the military-industrial complex, and it works," unquote. That, of course, is from the great Brian McGrath, Commander, U.S. Navy, retired, the managing director of the Ferry Bridge Group, a defense consultancy. As always, Brian's opinions when he comes on with us, which I mentioned in the pre-show, it's been over a decade he's been blessing us with his presence here on Midrats, are his own, and not necessarily affiliated with any organizations or companies he may spend some time with. Brian, welcome back to Midrats. It's great to have you aboard.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for having me. The blessing is mine to have this opportunity to talk with you guys.
Oh, you're too kind. And kind of like we do with authors of books, and I don't want to scare anybody away, your post that you put out on the 12th of February is not a book. But you can see the framework of somebody who wanted to write a book along of these lines. But just as a scene setter for the listeners who are now scrambling over to my Substack to grab it and read it, give us a brief outline about what your article has to say and what boosted you along to be able to go to the typewriter and pump it out.
Yeah, thank you. What I was responding to was a very positive thing, and that was this outpouring of praise and adulation for what the ships were doing in the Northern Red Sea and the performance of those ships and crews and combat systems under real-world combat conditions against targets ranging from easy targets to shoot down to ballistic missiles, anti-ship ballistic missiles, which is something no Navy on Earth has ever had to shoot down in combat before. So I was watching with great interest and great pride the praise that was coming the way of the surface force. I am in the tank for the surface force. I'm a former destroyer captain. I consult to both the surface force commander on the West Coast and to the director of surface warfare programs at the Pentagon. I do those things because that's where my interest is. And it's to the extent that I have anything I'm good at, that's what I'm good at. So I'm watching this force that I love and that I have spent so much time trying to help out, really getting a lot of praise and adulation. And then I saw an article in National Review about the military-industrial complex and about the delivery of the speech and Eisenhower's delivery of it. I think it's by a guy named Pino, who's a smart cookie. And I seized on one paragraph in Eisenhower's speech. It was his farewell to the nation, which had so much more than just a discussion of the military-industrial complex. But he warned the country, and it had special meaning coming from a retired five-star general and the leader of America's war effort in Europe. He warned against unwarranted influence by the military-industrial complex, and that phrase has come to be mangled in and shorthanded into another one that you hear all the time, which is beware the military-industrial complex. And I was thinking to myself, don't people understand that the things that they are praising and lauding today in the Red Sea are the result of that military-industrial complex? And I began to think about not only how over the course of one man's career, which was my own, which is the only one I'm really familiar with, the ships that I served on when I went from one to the next to the next to the next five times, they all got better. Each ship was more capable than the previous one. And I thought about how this was obviously not accidental. This was purposeful. This was the work of talented people achieving goals, setting goals and achieving goals over time. So I wanted to talk about what we see in the Gulf, in the Red Sea today, and how it is the result of the proper functioning of the military-industrial complex. I made a huge mistake in titling that article. I forget what I called it, something like in praise of the military industrial complex. I should have said something like in praise of one small portion of a large, unwieldy, out of control, corrupt and bloated military industrial complex that just happened to get it right in this one tiny little thing that is shooting things down in the air, because of course everything else is screwed up, corrupt, over budget, bloated, and terrible, and I am obviously a hack for the defense industry, and so here's my story. That's what I should have called it, but you have rules for how long your articles can be, so I called it what I called it. But the other thing that I wanted to do is I have worked in the Pentagon and around the Pentagon since 1997. And I've watched requirements officers in N96 come and go, and I've watched them work their butts off, just trying to find money for their programs, trying to advocate for the things that they need to advocate for, that trying to kill the things that they think are worth killing, working really hard. And I've watched them over the years, and I see it all the time. These guys, they come in, and they're full of piss and vinegar, and by the time they leave, they're beaten down because things don't move all that quickly in the Pentagon, and you don't measure progress in milestones. You mention it, you measure it in inch stones. It's not like going to sea. It's not like taking command of a mediocre ship and making it a great ship, that you can see every day the evolution of that kind of thing happening. Change happens slowly, and over the course of a 2 or 3 year tour, some of these guys get ground down and they get a little dejected. And what I've tried to do was to show how over 35 years, a series of ground down action officers and the actions that they took over that period of time mattered. It mattered in a very demonstrable way. It mattered in the lives that are being saved routinely in the Red Sea by weapon systems operated by well-trained sailors that are built to spec and built by a military-industrial complex that has its problems but is the envy of the world. That's an overblown way too wordy description of what I was writing about, but that's what I hope to accomplish with that piece. Over.
Yeah. I think one of the interesting aspects of that article from National Review by Pino, which is called What People Miss in Eisenhower's Farewell Address, is that since his time, the percentage of the GDP, which has been being spent by on defense, has dropped way down. I mean, it's not minuscule, but it's not what people think, that we're spending, 70% of our federal budget on defense. It's 15%. It's not anywhere close to what it was during Eisenhower's time. And I think that a lot of the people who complain about the military-industrial complex don't grasp that it's not the octopus they seem to think it is. It is an octopus, but it's not the octopus they think it is.
There are two broad categories of critics of the military-industrial complex. One is the critic who would rather see that money being put to other uses. Generally speaking, those are social programs. They are domestic programs, and that's an honorable position. That's what we do in a democracy: is we decide how to divide the pie and what are the most important places to put our money. The other group of people who criticize the military-industrial complex are a group of people who, for want of a better term, think they know better. Who, because they had a job, as a director of business operations for a $25 million defense contractor for 15 years in Arlington, Virginia, have solved forever and all times the mysteries of the military-industrial complex, and everybody else is screwed up. Everybody else is corrupt. If only people listened to me, if only people did what I said. That's the other brand of critic that we see quite a bit. And I hear from those people all the time. Over.
I think what's interesting about it, and goodness knows, I think both of us have had, like anything else you love or anyone else you love, you praise the good. But if you really love somebody, you have to point out where they don't meet their potential. They make a mistake. When you have affection for something, you aren't silent when they are hurting themselves and those they love, so to speak. So it's not perfect, but there is no human institution that is perfect. But when I first saw the draft of your post, I just kept going, yes. And we and others had started to point out just this great level of success. Yes, the Houthis are a non-state actor at best a fourth-rate power. But as you mentioned, they are throwing stuff at our fleet and our destroyers with their plus or minus a few years, 40-year-old skippers and their 20-something crew that nobody else has seen, the anti-ship ballistic missile, and also a very complicated environment with the everything from the flying lawnmower UAVs to some, no kidding, at least second-generation anti-ship cruise missiles that have made trouble for our navies and others a lot in the last few decades. And there is something that people should take a deep breath and go, yeah, this has worked, because it contrasts with you look at what the Russian Navy and the Black Sea has been able to face. And, you talked about an evolution. I do want to dive into it a little bit because I think that story is fascinating. But, you and I both have young midshipmen and JO experiences with the Knox-class frigates. And, your first ship was the USS McCandless, the FF-1084, which was commissioned in 1972. And you have the Moskva, which was actually hull one of the Soviet Slava class. It was commissioned 10 years later in 1982, roughly the same generation of ship. And we saw what happened to the Slava and a lot of the other Russian Black Sea fleet, that there is another, one of the better funded even though they had a little bit of a spot of bother after the Soviet Union, but in a global sense, an organization that had on paper a very impressive Navy. But when the ultimate test came, which is your lack of a better phrase, your non-permissive, non-scheduled range time when stuff is coming at you, they have not been able to perform. So looking at specifically the Aegis system, and if you want to tie that into the Arleigh Burkes and how that has developed, one of the Arleigh Burkes performed real well was the USS Laboon, DDG 58, which is a sister of the ship you turned over command to back in 2006, which was a Flight 1 Arleigh Burke. But they're out there performing as the American taxpayer would want. You know, what is it about that program that allowed them to be put in a situation where, you know, whether you're looking at what happened to the Fitzgerald and McCain, that was other issues. There hasn't been the Gold Star happy face news coming across, but even I think the most cynical critic of what the U.S. military does in a procurement point of view, I think has to step back and look, okay, something is working here. What is it?
Yeah, what's working there, there's a couple things. The foundational thing that worked there was a relationship between the government and industry that was, again, another instance of the military-industrial complex firing on eight cylinders. You had a Navy customer with sufficient technical capability in the oversight organs assigned to it, overseeing the design, testing, and production of two classes of ships, first the Ticonderoga-class cruiser and then the Arleigh Burke destroyer, both of which were, you know, one was a late 70s project, the other was a mid-80s project, and we built those ships for a long time. They were designed and supported by an organization and a Navy that concentrated on effectiveness and efficiency rather than efficiency over effectiveness. We win the Cold War and we lose our minds. Eviscerate NAVC and the technical oversight. We decide that we want to build ships built to spec, performance specs rather than design specs, which gives us one of the things it gives us is the LCS class. We threw out tried and tested approaches to fielding advanced capability, chasing the go-go world of efficiency. That was the military-industrial complex not working on eight cylinders. We got some turds in there. Nobody knows what they are better than the two of you. The LCS was a problem. The DDGX was a problem. Arleigh Burke destroyers have continued to plug along, and they plugged along because they retained much of the support mechanisms that it was born with. Not all of it. Don't get me wrong. We've taken away some of that support that they're trying to build slowly back to now, but it didn't just shed it all. And so we have the LPD-17 class, which was – you know, envisioned late, you know, right around the time the Cold War was over, we started to build, but we had a design. We got a mature design for it. We got a mature design for the Flight 1, 2, and 2 Alpha DDGs, and we built them in numbers, and we learned, and whatever we learned from the last ship, we rolled into the next ship. We held requirements generally set until we had a new tranche or a new flight, at which point we would implement those requirements. We lost our minds when we left the Cold War and we decided we were going to be efficient. And part of the problem was that we cut a workforce in the government whose job it was to oversee what industry does. I don't want to blame industry. I don't want to blame the government, but we used to have A plus B and it gave us C. Now we have A minus and B minus giving us C minus. And that's the way it's been for decades. The whole team, government and industry, is less than it used to be. And I think until we turn the corner on this, until we recognize, you know, as I say all the time, until we become serious again about building things, about designing things, about risk-taking and risk management. We hear about risk-taking all the time. And this, you know, it's our Silicon Valley friends love to make us the height of business performance is to take risks. No, the height of business performance is to manage risk. And we, quite frankly, haven't managed risk all that well.
It's interesting to me that the discussion evolves. I mean, is evolution evolutionary? I mean, your discussion is evolutionary. You know, every iteration of the BDG is an improvement on the one that came before. And I go back to Gearing class destroyers. I mean, the Gearing class destroyer was an improvement on the class that came before it. And you know, then all the destroyers that have come along since, all the improvements in radar, all those iterations, you know, they add up. So that, you know, if you're used to an SPS 26 surface search radar, and all of a sudden you're looking at Aegis, it is similar, but vastly improved over what we used to have. I was reading Admiral Sandy Woodward's book on 100 Days and thinking about the technology that he was trying to fight the Argentinians with and trying to see how that would have changed had he had the technology we have today and the iterations that are provided by somebody in the – I think you're somewhere in your article you point out that somebody in the Pentagon says, you know, I would really like to have this, your demand signal, and the industry guys go, oh yeah, we could do that, but somebody has to then say, okay, well, how much, you know, how are we going to fund this kind of thing, instead of, as you said with the LCS, well, here's our concept, make us like this, and we'll live happily with it, which I think is completely different than the iterations we've done with almost every other weapon system. The F-18, Alpha and Bravo, you know, goes to the current model of Super Hornets. They're completely different aircraft and much improved, but that is the process, the way it's supposed to work. Now talk about that a little bit and some of the changes that just like I said, if you're looking at Admiral Woodward's situation in that war, or what we were doing in Desert Storm, the differences in that time period of what we've got today. I mean, we were wunderkinds in those days. Everybody thought, boy, yeah, all the high-tech stuff we were doing, and that seems to me to have been, in retrospect, looking back all those years, I mean, that was ancient technology.
It was, and you know, let's face it, I have ideas about where the fleet ought to go and where the surface force ought to go and how to properly architect a combat system. I believe that what we have today may in fact be the class of the world, but it is a shadow of what I know we can do. Not, you know, some aspirational Buzz Lightyear kind of thing, but no, what we can do with the technology that the financial industry is moving billions of dollars in microseconds without a penny being lost and no data loss, we can import some of that, the technology that is out there today, into our ships in a way that's meaningful and gives us an incredible advantage. So I look at the ships that are in the Red Sea right now, and there are a number of different combat system baselines. There are very modern ones. There are some less modern ones. They are doing a wonderful job. I do want to caution everybody that it's dangerous, and that while I am proud of everything they're doing, someone may get hit. And people may get hurt, and we have to keep that in mind. But so far, what I'm seeing is that is exactly what I expected. And I think I put this in my article that, you know, when I looked at my ship and I trained my ship and I looked at my combat system, I believed that if we went out and took on a proper opponent, my technology would be better than theirs. And that we would win that fight. We may not win the industrial fight. We may not win the rock fight. But we're going to win that technology fight. And we're seeing that right now. We're seeing it in a big way. Now, a lot of critics are saying, yeah, we're shooting down, you know, flying lawnmowers with $2 million interceptors. Yes. Yes, we are. Yes, we are. That's what you do when you're not in a great power war with an industrial power. That's what you do when your margin for error is zero. That's what it is. The margin for error for those ships in the Red Sea right now is zero. If you take it in the snot locker with a telephone pole-sized surface-to-surface missile, your name is mud, and you're going to have to answer to a lot of justifiably angry parents and a chain of command. We don't have the luxury that we would have in a South China Sea scenario when you're getting literally scores of supersonic missiles being shot at you at one time. So, yes, we are targeting in some cases modestly capable targets with more capable interceptors. But that's what we have. That's what we've invested in, and that's what the margin of error gives us. Ultimately, what I hope is that we recognize that what we see in this petri dish of modern naval warfare is it wakes people up. It wakes people up. I was really happy to see the Surface Force commander at SNA in January say he was unsatisfied with the pace of development of directed energy weapons, lasers and high-powered microwave. Good on him, because, you know, directed energy has been just around the corner for 40 years, and I'm tired of it. I'm tired of hearing about it. I want us to field proper directed energy systems, which we can. I mean, the Army's got a 300-kilowatt laser on a truck in the desert. We can do this. We need people. We need someone like the Surface Force commander who has taken this on to stand up and say, I got this, and put his shoulder down and make it happen. Over.
And let's talk about that in the finest traditions of the naval service, because I've always thought that one of the reasons why we're having the success we have today is the way that Aegis was developed and standard missiles were developed. There's almost a little, I passively aggressively subtweeted a few people today. There is a certain industry, especially in the water that you swim in much more than I do, of people who they want to sell the above the fold, and they want to overpromise and underdeliver the sexy, the sparky, the transformational, the aren't I smart, you know. Directive energy is kind of like rail guns. They're going to be here the next POM cycle. We've heard that the last 12 POM cycles. It hadn't really happened. But with the development of Aegis, we had a rear admiral who was in a job for a long time that put his shoulder into that. And I may be guilty of this, that I've put Admiral Meyer up on a little bit of a pedestal there, but in many times with the failures we've seen, especially in the last few decades, I don't think enough people have looked back and said, look at how we did that. Why don't we do that until we do it better? Then we can do something new. what characterized the position he has? And is there, have we just created a system where nobody can do that again, to have that one person who, as you said, is putting his shoulder into it and is longer than a 24 to 36 month PMS cycle?
Well, yeah, what's interesting is you lay out the case of Admiral Meyer, but then there's also Rickover, and there was another admiral who was in the ballistic missile program for a long time. I don't remember his name, but we see the Navy seems to have this desire for messiahs to come along and lead us out of the desert, and we found those messiahs when we needed them. I'd like to think that there is a system that will support us making incremental gains over time in the absence of a messiah, that the process just works because smart people are in it. But I do recognize the value of long-term leadership at the top, stable leadership at the top. That's one thing that Aegis had, was Admiral Meyer pulling the strings. What Admiral Meyer also had, though, was something that doesn't exist today, which was somebody writing the checks who controlled the checks for manpower, maintenance, shipbuilding. The old Oppo 3 owned training. They used to refer to these guys as the warfare barons. I think warfare barons undershoots them. They were warfare dukes or warfare princes. These guys were incredibly powerful, and there were these partnerships between NAVC, broadly understood, and Oppo 3, broadly understood, that went on for years, where the guy writing the check could within his own program reallocate money and move it around in inventive ways and grab money to go over to capitalize on interesting developments in Aegis. That doesn't exist anymore. The director of surface warfare does not have anywhere near the N96, does not have anywhere near the budget authority that Oppo 3 had in 1983, Admiral Doyle, Admiral Roden Sr., those guys. They had immense amounts of money and the ability to, and it was semi-fungible within their purview. Rickover had a ton of money. And I'm not just arguing for money here. I'm arguing over control of money. We have so thoroughly parsed every pot of money to a fare thee well, and Congress and congressional staffers exercise eagle-eyed authority over every line item because there is some buddy in Congress or someone on Capitol Hill or even within the Defense Department who wants that money to be managed so closely. We've changed the way that we finance this whole enterprise so that it is harder. Even if the Messiah came along, I think it would be harder for the Messiah to do his job or her job. Because they can't pull the strings like they used to. The surface warfare, the SWO boss in San Diego, Admiral McLean, he runs the surface warfare enterprise, but what he really does is he exercises convening authority and influence over the Naval Supply System Commander, the Naval Sea Systems Commander, the PEO IWS, he cannot order them to do anything. And so we work together the best we can. We move the system along as best we can. But there are no messiahs. There are no people who can pull the strings. It is a harder environment to make change in, and we've done it to ourselves over.
Yeah, if I were a SWO admiral, which of course would never happen, but if I were one, I would be complaining about the way the drones, the UAVs and USVs and all the other Vs and unmanned stuff that would be beneficial to my section of the Navy is being handled. I would want, like the Marines, I would like every ship to have some say in what they want to carry as far as that kind of equipment, and I want them to use it and go out and play with it and experiment with it and then come back and say, well, you know, this works, this doesn't work. I don't want it to be driven by some air boss somewhere in the world who doesn't know what destroyers do and what they need or what cruisers need. And I think, I mean, I don't think too many surface guys tell the F-18 drivers, you know, this is what you really need, guys. I think that stovepiping of some of these things is a major problem. And when you talk about the funding, I think that's a huge part of the issue.
Well, I need to whine a little bit here, so Sal, you can offer me some cheese. It has ever been thus. Surface warfare is a bill payer, right? It's a bill payer for the submarine community, broadly understood, because submarines submerge and surface with nuclear power plants. And this country cannot afford talk about zero margin of risk. We cannot afford a reactor accident. We cannot afford to unsafely operate nuclear reactors. And so, quite rightly, the submarine force is the lead pig on the teats. They get what they need, right? The next is the aviation community. Why? Because we can't have airplanes falling out of the sky. That's just, we can't have it. And so we come down to the surface force, who gets plenty of money. Don't get me wrong. Surface force gets $1 billion every year to do what it needs to do. But it's not enough. And it always comes behind the requirements for aviation, for specifically carrier aviation, and for submarines. Nobody going to be N-96, nobody in Admiral Pyle's job, that's not a surprise to any of them. They understand that. Everybody in surface warfare understands that you've got to make your case. You've got to come forward with facts. You've got to have data. You've got to make the case. And so that's what surface warfare winds up doing, is trying to do a very evidence-based, analytically-based approach to, this is what we bring to the table. Here's what it's worth. Here's what it costs. At the end of the day, at N8 and N9 and the vice chief's office, those things have to get muscled in with all of the other needs, right? We need to build things. We need to have military construction. We need to pay for all sorts of things. Military personnel costs are amazing. So I wish it were different. I wish surface warfare got more money and was considered more important. I'm hoping that what people are seeing in the Red Sea wakes some up to the fact that, hey, this is a really important part of our peacetime global Navy, because what they're doing there, there's no declared war. This is what a peacetime Navy is doing in a time of restive peace. That's the surface warfare. That's what surface warfare does. It's out there deterring, assuring, responding to crisis, and carrying out national policy every single day. Over.
One thing that watching some of our allies try to do the same thing kind of creeped into my mind and is informed by your article is wanted to know who successfully made the argument, because the green ice ships are always coming after you when you have a ship. We need to save some money, so why don't we get rid of this system or that system? And as we talked about earlier on in the show, some of our Arleigh Burkes, who we will build till the crack of doom, we have 90-some-odd either afloat or on order. We'll get over 100 eventually, I'm quite sure. But some of these ships in the course of a day, they saw an anti-ship cruise missile. They saw an anti-ship ballistic missile. They had UAV attacks. They even had some had surface attacks. And all these Arleigh Burkes, depending upon the Burke you have SM-2, SM-3, SM-6, ESSM missiles. You've got TLAM for your land attack. You've got that multi-use 5-inch gun forward that everybody loves. And then you look at the Royal Navy, which is, from an intestinal fortitude point of view, they always come out. They want to play. But there some pictures came out over the weekend of their HMS Diamond, I think it is, one of their Daring class. They only have a half dozen, comparable to an Arleigh Burke. However, they have significant budgetary problems and have for a long time. So their version of the Arleigh Burke does not have land attack cruise missiles. Their main gun does not have an anti-air capability anymore because they decided to save money to no longer give it that ability. And as everybody does, in their case, have to go all the way back to Gibraltar to reload. So what in the Arleigh Burke program do you think what it was that we were able to convince the builders, the people who are writing the checks, that yes, we're going to have a wide variety of missiles on this because we really don't know who we're going to fight. So we want to have enough tools in the box to be able to deal with it. I think that also is an important lesson when you look at a closest peer like the Royal Navy, how those decisions can really make a difference.
Yeah. We have these debates in fleet architecture. One of the debates, people love single purpose ships, right? People love minesweepers, people like PHMs. They want us to build these ships that do one thing exquisitely well, because we used to do that. We used to have, as part of our fleet, a number of ships that were sort of single purpose ships. Well, there is an incompressible and irreducible amount of give-a-damn that a Navy has to do for every ship. You have to have people, you have to have grease, you have to have fuel, ammunition, food. All of that has to be carried on other ships. There have to be supply lines. There have to be depots. There have to be all of these things. There has to be a certain superstructure to support any class of ship. Therefore, it is almost always more efficient to have a ship that does multiple things rather than have multiple classes of ships do singular things. You catch me so far? So this is, one of the reasons why we have Arleigh Burke destroyers and Aegis cruisers that have anti-ship cruise missiles, land attack cruise missiles, surface-to-air missiles, hypersonic missiles. I think technically the SM-6 is hypersonic. Harpoon missiles. They have over-the-side torpedoes. They have anti-submarine rockets. They have towed array sonars, a bow-mounted sonar. What we did was we said, if we're going to create naval power, it's more efficient that those ships have multiple purposes, and then we can have more efficient supply and support mechanisms than to create singular ships that have or ships that have singular missions. That explains why we have DDGs and cruisers like we have today. That explains why the FFG when it comes out, at least Hull 2, will have most of those weapons, including a land attack variant. It's because if we're going to spend, you know, $1 billion a copy, we might as well get all of these things out of it. The Royal Navy has a much different problem to deal with, and that is they simply don't have the money or, in my view, the will to do much different from what they are capable of doing now. And what they're capable of doing now is to put out a modest number of capable, well-equipped ships that can do some things, but a ship that does what a modern Aegis cruiser or a modern Aegis destroyer or a future DDG-X does, it's just beyond them right now because it would suck up far too much of their military budget. So it's not that they couldn't do it, it's that they can't do it because they have other places their money needs to go. Over.
Yeah, one of the concerns that has been expressed, especially by Wayne Hughes in the past, was that by building these ships that are so capable, the loss of any one of those ships means that if you have to send your DDG back to Guam to rearm, assuming Guam is still there, you've then taken, you know, anti-air, anti-submarine, a tremendous asset that does all those things offline. And, you know, that was one of the arguments that he was making in favor of yes, the DDG's great, the cruiser's great, but also some single-purpose, smaller ships, the more expendable ships, that would keep you, you know, if you lost one, you didn't lose all the capabilities of a Burke class destroyer. So, you know, the question then I think one of the things points I really liked in your article were that, you know, when you first got to your FF, none of the components, the anti-submarine, the missiles, the just regular CIC stuff did not all communicate electronically. I mean, when the destroyer I was on, we had the sonar guys yelling over to the radar guys something. But, you know, the integration of all this stuff into a modern system, I think, is one of the most important things that's been accomplished over the years. Talk a little bit about that and why that is both a blessing and a curse if we lose one of these DDGs.
Well, don't get me wrong. Like everyone else in this field, I have a great deal of respect for Wayne Meyer. Professor you just – Wayne Hughes. Sorry, Wayne Hughes. I've looked at, you know, I've looked deeply at some of his fleet design ideas, and they have merit. One problem I've always had with Wayne Hughes's fleet designs is that I think he is guilty of underestimating how much those ships cost, number one. So the total cost of his fleet and total ownership costs are higher than he tends to give them, or have been higher than he tends to suggest. The problem, though, comes in the fact that we haven't been, for a long time, a war-fighting navy. We've been a war-deterring navy. We've been a put-a-bit-of-stick-about navy. We've been a navy that protects and sustains global order, our economy and security. And so when your Navy is doing those things over time and you have a certain amount of money available to spend on land-based maritime patrol, future vertical lift, new class of submarine, another new class of submarine, aircraft carriers, surface ships, when you have all of these places to put your money, and you look at your surface fleet, you then come back to it makes more economic sense for a fleet that is built both to fight and to influence, it makes more sense to build multi-mission ships. Now, that's not an argument for Death Stars. That's not an argument for, you could take this to its ridiculous extreme and think about, you know, some sort of a $25 billion Death Star kind of ship. But having a certain number, I personally would like to see fewer large surface combatants and more numerous smaller surface combatants. That when I say more numerous, I think about the FFG-X class. I'd like to see us building four or five of those a year as soon as possible. I think building one and a half large surface combatants, but very, very capable surface combatants. Surface combatants with a Spy 6 radar, with a Sea Whip Block 3, with an integrated power system, with a series of directed energy weapons on them. I would like to see us rebalance so that we have fewer large surface combatants and more numerous smaller surface combatants for essentially the same amount of shipbuilding money a year. That's going to take an intellectual argument. I make that argument all the time to really influential people. I have not carried the day. I want to build one and a half big ships and four smaller ships a year rather than building two big ships and two smaller ships a year, which means that I want to build five and a half ships for the same money it costs to build four ships, but that you would change the character of the surface force over time. I've made this argument. I haven't won it yet, and maybe before I hang it up someday, I can convince people. But for now, we're sort of stuck with building the big multi-mission ships. The thing that I think offers the most hope to alter this is unmanned surface vessels. If we're going to build modestly capable surface vessels, we might as well not put people on them or have them mostly unmanned. And that, to me, makes a lot of sense. And I think we are starting to see some really good ideas in unmanned, medium, small, and then even the large unmanned surface vessel, which is essentially a floating VLS magazine. We can offload those Wayne Hughes-inspired wartime kinds of single-mission platforms into the unmanned fleet, and I think we can do so within a more achievable total obligational authority. Over.
I would feel bad if I didn't, you know, quote you your article one more time. It's for those that read the comments and some of the other commentary about what you wrote. It's been kind of funny how you've triggered people on a few topics. It's the navalist sympathy for the devil type of speech. And one thing that nobody likes to throw a little love at, that you do actually throw a little love at, I'll do a little quote here, and then I'd like for you to expound on a little bit. It has to do with the defense budget. And this was towards the end of your article. It says, quote, "It never ceases to amaze me when I hear people talk about the defense budget as if it were a certain number of dollars that would provide an optimal level of national defense. In this fantasy world, incredibly smart analysts crunch numbers. The Department of Defense creates a bill for the Office of Management and Budget, and this bill is presented to the Congress, who pays it unflinchingly because of the obvious wisdom of the thinking that went into it, not to mention the unquestioned non-parochialism of the legislators involved. This is not how things are done. The inefficiency, the pork, the parochialism, the horse trading, the compromise, those are not bugs. This is the system." Unquote. Tell everybody why they got it wrong.
Do you have that at hand so you can read the very next sentence?
Oh, sure thing. It says right after, "This is a system. And it is a system that drives defense spending because there are no point solutions. There will always be inefficiency. That inefficiency gets papered over by additional resources. Lather, rinse, and repeat." You want me to finish the rest of the paragraph?
I have come to conclude that the closer we come to a perfect system of resource allocation, the farther away from representative democracy we will be. If we had an authoritarian government, if we had a king, we would be much, it would be much easier to achieve the kind of defense budget that a number of critics of my article seem to think is possible. It's not possible. We can't allocate resources that way. We have 535 members of Congress, each of whom believes that they are a venture capitalist. That's the way the system was created. And there will always be inefficiency because of that compromise. There's never going to be perfect allocation of resources to strategy. And it just bothers me that I hear really smart people sometimes falling victim to the sense that not only is there a more perfect way to do it, which there probably is, but that there is a perfect way to do this, which there certainly isn't. We have to recognize that this is my favorite example. For the Navy to grow, more money is going to have to be spent on the Navy. Period. End of story. The only way the Navy is going to get more money is if the Army gets more money, and the Air Force gets more money, and the Marine Corps gets more money, and the Space Force gets more money. Not because that's the strategically smart thing to do, but because that's how our system works. We're not good at making that kind of point solution, that kind of hard strategic choice. We have people in congressional districts who build tanks who will say, that's not a good idea. I need more money in order for me to vote for your this, that kind of log rolling, that kind of compromise. That's part of, that is our system. I think people lull themselves into a sense of security, thinking that if only we had more patriotic people, I might embarrass some of my hosts right now. If only we had term limits and could throw the bums out every 6 years or whatever, it would almost never work that way. As long as we continue to have geographically distributed representation in the lower chamber of Congress, and as long as states continue to send an equal number of representatives into the Senate, which is going to stay until this country is conquered or ceases to exist, we're going to have this kind of inefficiency, and we need to just recognize that.
Yeah. During some research for this show, I got a chance to look at the Eisenhower School. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but it used to be the Army Industrial College, and it became the Industrial College of the Armed Forces, now is known as the Dwight D. Eisenhower School for National Security and Resource Strategy. And its mission is to prepare select military officers and civilians for strategic leadership and success in developing national security strategy and evaluating, marshaling, and managing resources in the execution of that strategy. And I sit there and go, who are these people? And do we ever see them? And that, you know, look at your article, I'm thinking, there's a disconnect between what these people think they're doing at the Eisenhower School in the name of a man who had that military industrial complex speech, and what you just said about how the real world works. So talk about that a little
I'm
bit.
I'm just, I am amazed. I talk to flag officers all the time. These are brave men and women. These are people, I wish they had a more sophisticated understanding of that system, because they would recognize that there are so many people over there on Capitol Hill who want to help them, who want them to succeed. But I think sometimes because there are others over there who are clearly antithetical to the Navy's interests, or who act antithetically to the Navy's interests. They seem to think that all are, but they're not. There's a good bunch of people over there, especially in the committees that help the Navy or that oversee the Navy. This is why, you know, this administration sent, you know, its first two budgets up the Capitol Hill, and Congress added, I think, between $40 and $60 billion to each of those, because there are interests up there that are different than the interests in the Pentagon, and that's the way the system works. And if the Navy, if flag officers understood that system and appreciated it and exploited it, that's the word I'm going to use, exploited it in a little more sophisticated manner, I think we'd be in a better place.
Well, Brian, on that note, we've kept you for the full hour. I really appreciate you taking time this Sunday to chat with us. I would highly recommend everybody who's listening, look at the show page, and if you're catching the podcast, you'll find the link there as well. Link, you can go read Brian's article and some of the other stuff he's putting out. You also have your own Substack. So if people would like to keep an eye on what you're working on, where's a good place for them to keep their eyeballs and their computers looking?
Well, obviously your Substack is a key place, because when I want to reach an influential audience quickly, I call you and I say, hey, do you got room for me? And I appreciate how often you say yes unflinchingly. Or you can go to my own Substack, The Conservative Wahoo, where you can see where I sometimes write about the Navy and sometimes write about just life in these United States.
Perfect. Well, really appreciate it, Brian. And we're coming up on spring, so I hope the rest of 2024 works out well for you and yours, and I look forward to next time having a conversation.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Take care.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Until next time, hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Oh!